Good morning. Welcome to Lesson 32 of our study of the book of Joel. Lesson 32. We're in chapter 3, still in verse 2. But we're zeroing in on the end of the book. There is a handout in the back if you'd like to pick one of those up. It's got a map on it you might find helpful as we talk about some of the places on that map today that are mentioned in Joel chapter 3. If you're missing any handouts or audio, video, class notes, anything like that, you can find it on the internet at studyjoel.com, studyjoel.com. And that will remain up even after the class is over if you'd like to go back and find any of that material, as well as any of the other classes I've taught here, Zechariah, Ezra, Esther, Daniel, Hosea, maybe a few others. Let's begin our class with a prayer. Our dear Father in heaven, we're thankful for this beautiful day and this great blessing that we have to gather together, Father. We're thankful for your church, Father. We're thankful for that stone that was not cut with human hands. We're thankful for the eternal kingdom of Christ. We're thankful that the church is your household. We're thankful that the church is the body of Christ, Father. It is such a great blessing that we've been added to that beautiful church and your wonderful kingdom, Father, by obedience to the wonderful gospel of Christ. And we pray these things in his name. Amen. Well, let's pick up where we left off last time, which was in verse 2 of Joel chapter 3, verses 2 and 3 of Joel chapter 3. I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, and I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my heritage Israel, because they have scattered them among the nations and have divided up my land and have cast lots for my people, and have traded a boy for a prostitute and have sold a girl for wine and have drunk it. Well, when we ended last week, we were looking at the Valley of Jehoshaphat. We were trying to figure out where and what is that valley. And we had looked last week and we ended at two of three options for that valley. Our first option we looked at last week was the Valley of Berakah, where God had given King Jehoshaphat a great victory over the enemies of God's people. And they didn't even have to lift a finger. God did all the work for them in that valley. The second option we looked at was the Valley of Jezreel, which is the most famous battlefield on earth near Megiddo. And it is associated with the judgment of the nations in Revelation 16. So it's a pretty common choice for the Valley of Jehoshaphat. But we were just about to look at the third option when we ended last week. And the third option is the Kidron Valley. And if you still have your handout from last week, you can see it there at the bottom of the handout from last week, not this week. And if you're missing your handout from last week, you know where to go, studyjoel.com. The Kidron Valley is located east of Jerusalem in between the city and the Mount of Olives. Throughout history, I think the Kidron Valley has been the most popular choice for the Valley of Jehoshaphat. In fact, if you look at a lot of particularly older maps, you'll just find it labeled the Valley of Jehoshaphat. They seem awfully certain that that's what it is. It's a very popular choice, particularly on older maps. Why has it always been so popular? Well, it's not because of anything King Jehoshaphat did. It's because of the meaning of his name, which is God has judged. And then because of the association that the Kidron Valley has with the judgment of God. Well, how is the Kidron Valley associated with the judgment of God? And the answer is, when we look through the Old Testament at what happened in the Kidron Valley, what we find is that it was a dumping place for all things opposed to God, particularly false idols. For example, in 2 Kings 23, verse 6, we find King Josiah bringing out the Asherah from the house of the Lord to the brook Kidron and burning it at the brook Kidron. And we find other examples in the Old Testament as well. So it seems like the Kidron Valley was a pretty well-known dumping ground for things opposed to God. So that makes a lot of people think it's a pretty good spot for God to take care of these nations who are opposed to him here in this valley. But I think we can say more than just the valley is associated with the judgment of God. I think we can also say it's associated with the judge. It's associated with Christ. When Jesus made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, he came from the Mount of Olives, which means he crossed over the Kidron Valley and entered the city from the east. Later, after the Last Supper, to get to the Garden of Gethsemane, you again had to cross over the Kidron Valley to get to the Garden of Gethsemane in John 18. And when we look at Ezekiel and we look at the great prophecies there and we ask, well, from what direction did the glory of God return to the temple in Ezekiel What we find in Ezekiel 43:2 is that it came from the east. And if you're entering the city from the east, you cross over the Kidron Valley. So the glory of God returning to the temple crossed over the Kidron Valley in Ezekiel 43. And that link with Ezekiel really got me to thinking, because we've seen another link with Ezekiel already. It's the link in Ezekiel 39 to the pouring out of God's Spirit. And you can see that on the right side of today's handout, lower right side, you can see the prophecy from Ezekiel about the pouring out of God's Spirit. And here is another possible link to Ezekiel, Ezekiel 43. And then if you look at the left side of today's handout, I put a lot more links to Ezekiel in there. We're going to talk a little more about that later, but I think we're seeing here something that's very interesting, and that is we may be seeing some important links between Joel and Ezekiel. Now, we know when Ezekiel was written, because Ezekiel was written from Babylon. It was written shortly after the exile. And if, in fact, Joel is in some sense a preview of Ezekiel, that's going to go a long way to telling us when the book of Joel was written. But let's leave that discussion for a little later. For right now, let's just kind of have our antenna up when it comes to the book of Ezekiel and any links between Ezekiel and Joel. So our question now, though, is which is it? Which valley is this? Is it the Valley of Berakah? Is it the Valley of Jezreel? Is it the Valley of Kidron, the Kidron Valley? Well, again, I don't think we can rule any of them out. Any of them could be true. It may, in fact, be that none of them is true. It may be there's another valley that we haven't even looked at that's involved here. Or it may be that this valley is purely figurative. Later in this same chapter, we're going to find a valley of decision, which, you know, seems pretty clearly to be figurative. And maybe this valley of Jehoshaphat is just a valley of judgment. Jehoshaphat means God has judged. So maybe this valley is purely figurative. But if I had to choose, I would go with option number one, the Valley of Berakah that we looked at last week. Yes, it's the least popular option, but this isn't the first time I've taken the least popular route. Valley of Berakah. Now, option three, the Kidron Valley, would be a close second in my book, and mainly because of its association with Ezekiel. So, I don't know. It might take over the top spot at some point. But for right now, I like the Valley of Berakah for the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Why do I prefer the least popular option? Well, for starters, it's the only valley of the three that's actually associated with Jehoshaphat. The other two are not. The Valley of Berakah is where King Jehoshaphat achieved a great victory through God for his people. And Jehoshaphat didn't even have to lift a finger. His people didn't have to lift a finger. God did all the work in that Valley of Berakah for his people. And remember how God described it in 2 Chronicles 20, verse 15. For the battle is not yours, but God's. Now, I love that. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, isn't that a good theme for us, for the church? The battle is not yours, but God's. God is winning this battle and has won this battle for us. When I see that verse and I read Joel 3, I have a hard time picking any valley other than the Valley of Berakah for this Valley of Jehoshaphat. Even more so when I read King Jehoshaphat's prayer. You remember the King Jehoshaphat's prayer in 2 Chronicles 20 that led up to that victory? 2 Chronicles 20, verse 12. This is King Jehoshaphat's prayer. O our God, will you not execute judgment on them? For we are powerless against this great horde that is coming. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are on you. Don't you love that? Don't you love that? I like the Valley of Berakah. But whichever valley we choose, and whether we choose a literal valley or a figurative valley or a literal valley with a figurative meaning, the first thing that happens in verse 2 is that God gathers these nations in this valley. And as we said last week, that's not a place where you want to be. Well, what happens next? I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my heritage, Israel. What happens next is judgment. Judgment. And why is God gathering and judging the nations? Verse 2 tells us he's doing it on behalf of his people. He's doing it on behalf of his heritage. God is judging these nations because of what they had done to God's people and what they had done to God's heritage. And when? When does God do this? When does God gather these nations together for judgment? Well, I think we've already answered that question multiple different ways. I think the time frame in Joel 3 verse 1 is the same time frame in Joel 3 verse 2. I don't see any reason to change time frames here, and I see every reason to keep the same time frame. And if that's the case, if that's what's going on here, then these judgments were happening on the day when Christ established his eternal kingdom. The day when the stone cut without hands rolled down and smacked that statue into smithereens in Daniel chapter 2. Earlier, we looked at a lot of evidence for that view. Do we have any more evidence for that view now that we're here in verse 2? Would I ask that question if the answer was no? We do have more evidence. And we have that evidence when we compare Joel 3 verse 2 with something we read in another chapter 3, Zephaniah chapter 3. Zephaniah chapter 3. Listen to Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 8. Therefore, wait for me, declares the Lord, for the day when I rise up to seize the prey. For my decision is to gather nations, to assemble kingdoms, to pour out upon them my indignation, all my burning anger. For in the fire of my jealousy, all the earth shall be consumed. Now, doesn't that sound familiar, Zephaniah 3, verse 8? It's sounding a lot like what we're seeing here in Joel 3, verse 2 and verse 3. Well, when did Zephaniah 3, verse 8 happen? Keep reading. Let's read verse 9 of Zephaniah 3. For at that time, whenever you see that phrase in the Bible, highlight it, circle it, do something. For at that time, I will change the speech of the people to a pure speech that all of them may call upon the name of the Lord and serve him with one accord. Doesn't that sound like the church right there? Doesn't that sound like Joel 2:32? And it shall come to pass that everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Joel 2:32. Doesn't that sound like Zephaniah 3 verse 9? What happened in Zephaniah 3 verse 8? God judged the nations. When did that happen? Zephaniah 3 verse 9 tells us. It happened when all called upon the name of the Lord and served him with one accord. That's the church. That's looking at the church. I think Daniel 2, Joel 3, Zephaniah 3 are all describing the same thing. God's judgment of the kingdoms of this world on the day that he established the eternal kingdom of his son. On that day, every earthly nation of this world was weighed in the balances and found wanting, just like Babylon in Daniel 5. Now, this part of verse 2 creates a bit of a problem for those commentaries who so far have seen nothing but locusts in the book of Joel. And they know who they are. Are we still looking at locusts here? Is God gathering insects so that he can judge them? I don't know of any commentary willing to go quite that far. But if not, then how do they explain this sudden jump from locusts in Joel 1 and locusts in Joel 2, as they see Joel 2, to suddenly nations in Joel 3? Are these nations being judged because of what the locusts did? Were these nations responsible for the locust invasion? The answer, and I might suggest the only answer that actually makes any sense here, is that Joel 2 is not about an army of locusts. Joel 2 is about an army of people, which in fact is exactly what Joel 2 verse 2 says it is all about. People, not locusts, people. Joel 1 tells us about an army of locusts that had just come. Joel 2 warns the people about an army of people that is coming and that is near, but isn't here yet. And yes, in some ways, that army of people reminds them of that army of locusts because there are some similarities, but there are also some key differences that we looked at. And then what happens in Joel 3? In Joel 3, God judges that nation from Joel 2 along with all the other nations of this world. In short, the book of Joel makes perfect sense when we see locusts in chapter 1 people in chapter 2 and judgment in chapter 3. And the book of Joel makes no sense if we see locusts in chapter 1, only locusts in chapter 2, and suddenly people in chapter 3. But what specifically had these nations done? What had they done? Verses 2 and 3 tell us. They'd scattered them among the nations. They'd divided up the land. They'd cast lots for the people. They'd traded a boy for a prostitute. They'd sold a girl for a drink of wine. Now, we still have not decided yet when the book of Joel was written. That question has been hanging over our head for 32 lessons. When was Joel written? We've been looking at three options. The early view, the pre-exile view, and the post-exile view. And if you weren't here for those lessons, we got handouts and everything else going into all those three options. We've been looking at those three options for when the book was written, and we haven't picked a winner yet. Although the pre-exile view, as we've said several times, is pretty far ahead in the race. The evidence in Joel 3 verse 2 is one reason we haven't picked a winner yet. I didn't want to pick a winner until we'd gotten to Joel 3 verse 2, because this is pretty important evidence. At least we're told it's pretty important evidence. And some commentaries tell us it is the most important evidence on when the book was written. Joel 3 verse 2 and verse 3. Well, is it? Is it the most important evidence? I'm not so sure. Why? Why not? Well, the main reason is that these verses are not about a single nation, are they? I mean, look at it. It's about nations, plural. It's about what they, plural, have done to God's people. So it doesn't really make sense to me to look at these two verses and ask ourselves, well, is that Assyria or is that Babylon? The answer is it's not any single nation. It's nations, plural. They, plural. Now, we could certainly ask whether any specific nation is included in these descriptions. For example, is Assyria included? It does use the word scattering, and Assyria was the great scatterer of God's people, 2 Kings 17, verse 6. But you know what? Assyria was not the only scatterer. In fact, one of God's prophecies against Assyria, the one in Nahum 2 verse 1, is that Assyria itself would be scattered by Babylon. Babylon was also a scatterer. Well, what about dividing up the land? That's also mentioned here. Well, dividing up the land is what happened after a people conquered someone else and then divided up their land, gave it to themselves and the people in the conquering nation. It's the spoils of war is what we see there with dividing up the land. And of course, that happened very often in the history of Israel. In fact, all you really have to do is look at the shrinking map of the 12 tribes to see how often that happened, right? I mean, we looked at that when we studied Hosea. Remember, it started off like a pretty big map. You've all seen it with the 12 tribes, and they're here, and they're here, and they're here all throughout. And then it got smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and suddenly we're just down to like this. Okay, well, that's the spoils of war. That's dividing up the land. And it happened frequently in Israel and Judah's history. But not only did these nations divide up the land, they also divided up the people. They cast lots for God's people. And then having won a boy, they would trade him for a prostitute. Having won a girl, they would trade her for a drink of wine. The picture here is of a conquering people who care nothing for the people of God. Nothing. They conquer them. They then sell them for whatever they can get. They scatter them. They take their land. They sell their children. Did they value those children? They did not. Look what it says. They sold them just for enough money to spend a night with a prostitute or just enough money to have a drink of wine. They cast lots for God's people. That really speaks volumes, doesn't it? Particularly to us in New Testament times, because we can read in John 19, 23 and 24, how they cast lots for the garments of Christ and then divided up the garments among them. Casting lots, dividing up. We see both of those things right here in Joel 3, 2 and 3, don't we? Both of them. It is certainly not explicit. But I think there's an implicit prophecy about Christ here. I think the text is inviting us now, from our perspective, to look back and think about how this world values the people of God and the things of God. And the answer is they place no value on them. None. Here, the world placed no value at all on the children of God's people. And this evil world would later place no value on God's only begotten Son. They crucified him. They cast lots for his cloak, divided up his garments. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 8, none of the rulers of this age understood this. For if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. None of the rulers understood it. The sad truth is that the world has never placed any value on the people of God or the things of God. We see that here. We see that later when the world rejected and refused and crucified God's greatest gift of all, his Son. Verse 4. What are you to me, O Tyre and Sidon, and all the regions of Philistia? Are you paying me back for something? If you're paying me back, I will return your payment on your own head swiftly and speedily. Now, some commentaries, when they get to that verse, say, oh, well, that was very clearly written by someone other than Joel at a much later date and then just tacked on to the book. And why do they say that? Well, they say that because they say it would be awfully odd for Joel to be talking all about the end of the world and then suddenly to switch off to some what they call relatively minor incidents of ethnic crimes against Israel. And so they conclude, well, verse 4 couldn't have been in the original version of Joel, they say. Well, that's one way of proceeding. But why don't we think about another way instead? And in this other way, when the Bible doesn't agree with some theory we have about it, we toss our theory instead of tossing some verse from the Bible. How does that sound? Does that sound like a better approach? I think it's a better approach. Liberal scholars are lacking in many areas, but one area in which they are definitely not lacking at all is the exalted view they have of their own opinions about the Bible. Because when their opinion about the text differs with the text, what is it that we see heading out the window of that ivory tower? The Bible, not their theory about it. They very quickly discard any text in the Bible that disagrees with their theory about the book or the text. But rather than toss verse 4 because it doesn't read like the end of the world, maybe we should instead think that maybe verses 2 and 3 aren't about the end of the world. In fact, we've already seen they're not about the end of the world because we're given a time frame for verses 2 and 3 and verse 1. We've talked about it. I think we're looking at the judgment of the nations here. The same one that happened in Acts 2, the same one in Daniel 2, the same one in Daniel 7, the same one in Psalm 2, the same one in Zephaniah 3, the same one in Zechariah 12. And if that's correct, then verse 3 is just doing what we saw in verses 2 and 3. And that is that verse 4 here is just giving us more reasons why these nations are being judged. I think that's what verse 4 is doing. The only difference in verse 4 is that suddenly God is naming names. Tyre, Sidon, Philistia. Tyre and Sidon were Phoenician cities. So we're looking at two nations here, Philistia and Phoenicia. And perhaps the first thing we should notice is that Joel is suddenly being unusually specific. I mean, where was this specificity in chapter 1, Joel? Where was this specificity in chapter 2, Joel? Suddenly in chapter 3, what's going on here? There are 16 proper names in the book of Joel. 16. And if we throw out Joel, his father, Judah, Jerusalem, Israel, Eden, two valleys, and Zion, that leaves 7 proper names. Edom, Egypt, the Greeks, Philistia, Sabaeans, Sidon, and Tyre. What can we say about all 7 of those proper names? They're all in chapter 3. They're all in chapter 3. You know, Chapter 2 talked about a huge army, army of people coming against the people of God to just destroy them and wipe them off the map and judge them and blah, blah, all and on in chapter 2. Never did it tell us who they were. Not one time did it say in Joel chapter 2, and that huge army is, we didn't find a thing about it. Suddenly we're in chapter 3 and we have all these names. What's going on? Well, we talked earlier about why Joel 2 may have been very vague when it came to the identity of that people. We had some reasons for that. Why don't we see that same vagueness in chapter 3? Well, I think the most likely answer is something we've also talked about earlier, and that is Hebrew poetry. This is actually a pretty common example of Hebrew poetry where you move from the general to the specific. It's even today, it's a literary technique. You give a general statement and then you make that statement concrete by giving specific examples. And I think that's really what we're seeing here in chapter 3. And we're going to continue seeing in chapter 3. And I think when we look at these verses, we see even more examples of Hebrew poetry. It's repetitive. It's parallel. I mean, those are the two key features of Hebrew poetry. I mean, look at it. They have scattered. They have divided. They have cast. They have traded. They have sold. They have drunk. I mean, it just has all the hallmarks of Hebrew poetry. Now, why do I mention that again? Because we've already looked at Hebrew poetry. Why do I mention it again? Well, look at your Bibles. If you're using the English Standard Version, you'll notice the text has switched back to prose, right? I mean, it's no longer typeset like poetry. It's now typeset like prose. Why did they switch back to prose here? To which I say, good question, because it sure looks like Hebrew poetry to me. I think it may just be an example of, you know, one of them did it, so they all decided to do it. But I think we're still looking at some Hebrew poetry here. I think most of the book is written that way, and we have talked about that earlier. But let's get back to the Phoenicians and the Philistines. They were both coastal neighbors of Israel. You can see them on the map there, keeping in mind that Sidon and Tyre are Phoenician cities. They're all on the coast. Now, the Philistines, of course, we know about them. Long-standing enemies of God's people. Long-standing enemies of the Jews. Well, just how long-standing are we talking about here? You know, there's a word today you hear on the news a lot that comes from the word Philistia, Philistine, and that word is Palestine, Palestine, Palestinian. Yeah, that's pretty long-standing, don't you think? In fact, Ezekiel 25, verse 15, describes that conflict as, quote, a never-ending enmity. I think you'd be hard-pressed to disprove that today. The Philistines' proximity to Israel made them especially dangerous. They were very close. In fact, the Philistine city of Ekron is only 22 miles away from Jerusalem, and there's nothing in between. There's no natural boundary in between the two. They were very close and very antagonistic. Again, it seems like we're reading the newspaper, doesn't it? From the period of the judges until the rise of Assyria, that area, that little area between Jerusalem and the Philistines was constant warfare. Then eventually the Assyrians came in 712 and took out most of the Philistines. Now, the Phoenicians were similar to the Philistines in one way and very unlike the Philistines in another way. The way they were similar is that they were also coastal neighbors. A little further away, but coastal neighbors. They were different another way, though, very different. And that is the Phoenicians often enjoyed friendly relationships with the Jews. They weren't always at war with the Jews. In fact, King David and King Solomon had a relationship with King Hiram. King Hiram, who was a king of Tyre. And we know that he helped with the temple. King Ahab, an evil king, but he's very friendly with the Phoenicians. How do we know that? He married one of them, Jezebel, the daughter of the king of Sidon. The Phoenician cities of Tyre and Sidon, they were about 35 and 60 miles or so north. You can see them again on the map there for lesson 32. They were very wealthy. They were traders. They were centers of commerce, extremely wealthy. Zechariah 9, verse 3, Tyre has built herself a rampart and heaped up silver like dust. and find gold like the mud of the streets. Gold to them was like the mud in the streets. That's how wealthy they were. But friendly relations or not, Tyre and Sidon are both listed among the great enemies of God's people. Great enemies of God's people. Judges 3, 1 through 3, in fact, tell us that the Sidonians were among those nations and those cities that God specifically left in the land to test Israel. And both Isaiah and Ezekiel devote entire chapters, not just little sections, but entire chapters to condemning Tyre. Isaiah 23, Ezekiel 26, Ezekiel 27. And who was behind Tyre? I mean, who was it that was sometimes using Tyre as a frontal assault type enemy and sometimes using Tyre as a temptation for wealth and false gods? Who was sometimes dangling Tyre in front of the people of God like a lure? Who was doing that? Who was pulling Tyre's strings? I think the Bible may answer that indirectly. Let me describe somebody, and you tell me who I'm talking about. He was full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. He was in Eden, the garden of God. He was an anointed guardian cherub. He was on the holy mountain of God. He was blameless until unrighteousness was found in him. God cast him as a profane thing from the mountain of God. His heart was proud because of his beauty, but God cast him to the ground. Now, who does that sound like? To me, it sounds like Satan, doesn't it? Don't you think about Satan? He was in the garden. He was filled with pride because of his beauty. But unrighteousness was found in him, and God cast him down. Doesn't that sound like Satan? Each of those descriptions that I just read comes from the same chapter in the Old Testament. And each of them is about someone other than Satan. The chapter is Ezekiel 28. And the person being described is the king of Tyre, the king of Tyre. We're talking about the king of a city there, not the king of the Phoenicians, the king of Tyre, a city. Why is such language used to describe the king of a city? In my opinion, much of the language in Ezekiel 28 is describing who was behind the king of Tyre, who was pulling that king's string and using the king of Tyre to harm the people of God. I think Ezekiel sometimes looks past the king of Tyre to look at who was behind the king of Tyre. I think that's what's going on in that chapter. And if that's correct, that really drives home just how terrible an enemy Tyre was. Yes, the Philistines were bad, but one thing you can say about a Philistine, both then and now, is that they're pretty easy to figure out. There's nothing subtle about a Philistine. But not so with Tyre. Not so with Sidon. They were sometimes openly hostile, but sometimes they were like, hey, we're friends. And why don't you come try out some of my false gods? Wouldn't you like some of this gold? You know, we often hear people called Philistines today, and we got to guard against the Philistines, and I'm sure that's true. But I think the people we really need to guard against are the people of Sidon and Tyre who are still with us today. Their enmity against God's people is often very subtle. And I think Satan is also very subtle. I think Satan most often prefers a side attack rather than hitting you straight on. Now, with that background, let's look at what God says to them. What are you to me? Are you paying me back for something? Because if you're paying me back for something, I'm going to return it on your own head swiftly and speedily. What are you to me? What are you to me? That is not something you ever want to hear from God, is it? You know what reminds me of? Matthew 7:23, we find that someday Jesus will turn to people and say to them, "I never knew you. What are you to me? You're not my people. You're not my people." And as evidence of that, we're told that they're trying to pay God back for something. They're seeking vengeance against God. They're trying to get even with God. Well, how's that working out? Not well. God says he's going to return their payment back on their own head, swiftly and speedily. Now, if we're making a list of things that we don't ever want to hear from God directed at us, I think we just found our second item on our list, because I don't want to hear that either. What had these nations done to God's people? What had God done to these nations that they're seeking revenge? And how is God going to pay them back swiftly and speedily? I think those questions are answered in one way by something that Philistia, Tyre, and Sidon all had in common, and that is they weren't good neighbors to God's people. Instead, they kind of liked to gloat when bad things happened to the Jews. They liked to rejoice anytime the Jews were sorrowing. We know that's true of Tyre and Sidon after the Babylonians invaded, because Ezekiel 26:2-3 tells us that. Tyre said concerning Jerusalem, "Aha, the gate is broken. It's swung open. I shall be replenished now that she is laid waste." In other words, Tyre saw that as a wonderful opportunity to do what? To make a little more money. And of course, when Tyre and Sidon gloated over Israel's misfortunes, what they were really saying is they were gloating over what they saw as a failure by God to protect his people. Ha, ha, ha. You trusted in God and look where you are now. That's what Tyre said. That's what Sidon said. I think that's why God characterizes their taunts the way that he does. What are you to me? Are you paying me back for something? In other words, why are you bringing me into this? And are you really sure you want to bring me into this? Be careful what you ask for. And perhaps we should add, that attitude from Tyre, that attitude from Sidon, it hadn't gone anywhere. It hadn't gone anywhere. We've seen it this past week, haven't we, in the news? With the storms? Haven't we seen that attitude? Did you see all those people praying to God before the storm hit? They lost their house just like the ones who didn't pray. Doesn't that prove that God doesn't care at all about them? Did you see those people praying for their sick relative to recover and then their sick relative died? Doesn't that prove God doesn't love them? Doesn't that prove God doesn't care about them? Doesn't that prove God is not listening to them? That is nothing more and nothing less than what Tyre and Sidon said to the Jews. Every time the Jews suffered some misfortune. And you know what? That is what Satan said to Eve in the garden. God doesn't care about you. That's what Tyre and Sidon, I suspect, said when those locusts showed up in Joel 1. We know it's what they said when the army showed up in Joel 2, because Ezekiel tells us that. And what is God's response to that? Both then and now, what is God's response to that? What are you to me? Are you paying me back for something? Are you really sure you want to know the difference between being a child of mine and being a child of the devil? Are you really sure you want to know the difference? Because there is a difference, I think God is saying. You'll find out one of these days, I think God is telling them. You won't like the answer. I think that attitude is one reason we're seeing Israel's neighbors in this verse. I don't think it's the only reason. We're going to find some other reason. But boy, I think it's a big reason. I think another thing we can say about verse 4 is that an attack against God's people is an attack against God. Saul certainly found that out, didn't he? Acts 9, verse 4. Saul had been persecuting the church. Then he meets Christ. And what does Jesus say to him? Why are you persecuting me? Me. So I think that's why we see Philistia, Tyre, and Sidon. Well, what about the ones we don't see here? Where is Assyria on this list? Where is Babylon on this list? Why start off with Tyre and Sidon when we have Assyria and Babylon? After all, Jeremiah 50 verse 17 tells us that Assyria had devoured God's people and Babylon was gnawing on their bones. Why not start off with them? Now, some people say, commentaries say, well, the fact that Joel doesn't mention Assyria or Babylon means either that Joel has a very early date before Assyria and Babylon were world powers, or Joel has a very late date after they were no longer world powers. But I think that view is completely wrong. Why? Because of what we find when we look at another Old Testament prophet, Ezekiel. Ezekiel. We know when Ezekiel was written. Ezekiel was written after the Babylonian exile. In fact, Ezekiel was written from Babylon. Joel has only 3 chapters, for which some of you may now be very thankful. Ezekiel has 48 chapters. 48 chapters. How often does Ezekiel mention Assyria? 8 times. 8 verses. So the fact that Joel doesn't mention Assyria does not mean that Joel must have been written very early or very late. Ezekiel only mentions it 8 times in 48 chapters. Joel's only 3 chapters. So that doesn't prove anything about the date of Joel. What about Babylon? Well, Ezekiel does have a lot more to say about Babylon, as we would expect. But you know what? He's not always condemning it. Ezekiel 29 verse 19, "Behold, I will give the land of Egypt to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon." Ezekiel 30 verse 24, "I will strengthen the arms of Babylon and put my sword in the king's hand." Well, what if instead we go through Ezekiel and find out who does he condemn? What are the nations condemned in Ezekiel from Babylon? Well, Tyre is condemned in Ezekiel 26, 1 through Ezekiel 28, 19, which is almost 3 entire chapters. Sidon is condemned in Ezekiel 28, 20 through 24. These are all on the handout on the left side. Philistia is condemned in Ezekiel 25, 15 through 17. Egypt is condemned in Ezekiel 29 through 32, which is 4 chapters. Edom is condemned in Ezekiel 25, 12 through 14. Well, what can we say about those 5 nations and cities condemned in Ezekiel? They're the same ones we find right here in Joel chapter 3. Same ones. It's the same list. The same list. And again, we know when Ezekiel was written. We know where it was written. We know when, we know where. Far from providing evidence of a very early or a very late date, I think Joel 3 may be the very best evidence for the pre-exile view of when this book was written. Perhaps the time has finally arrived for us to say when the book was written, to reach a decision. And here's my decision. I think the pre-exile view is correct. I think that's when the book was written, right before the exile by Babylon. That horse has been leading the race for quite a while. I'm declaring a winner. I think Joel was written not long before the exile to give a preview of what Ezekiel wrote not long after the exile. Both of them have a great deal to say about Christ, a great deal to say about the kingdom of Christ. Ezekiel 40 through 43, for example, are some of the strangest chapters you'll ever find in the Bible. It's a giant architectural blueprint describing a huge temple where God would dwell forever. I think when we study those chapters, we find that that's the church. Same church Joel was talking about in Joel 2. Peter talking about in Acts 2. So why don't we see Assyria mentioned in Joel? Because Assyria was past history, and because Assyria was more a problem for the northern tribes than for Judah. And why don't we see Babylon mentioned by name in Joel? Likely because Babylon was still in their future. Hadn't happened yet. And because it could have been averted entirely if the people had repented. We saw that in Joel chapter 2. And also because God was at this time using Babylon as his own tool for his own purposes. And perhaps we can even say the Philistines and the Phoenicians were mentioned instead, not because they were world powers, but because they were not yet world powers. They were not world powers. In other words, I think the message may be here that no one's going to escape. If the Philistines and the Phoenicians thought they could hide in a corner while God judged Assyria and Babylon, they are badly mistaken because God is going to start with them. God's going to judge all the nations. And isn't that what Joel 3:2 says? I will gather all the nations. And that judgment would come swiftly and speedily. We'll talk about what that means next week. We'll continue on through the third chapter of Joel. Thank you very much for your attention.